Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm here in the Sky News studio and joined by their business presenter, Ian King. Described by Sky's head of news, John Riley, as a powerhouse in business journalism, Ian began his career as an analyst at HSBC before working for national newspapers including The Daily Telegraph, The Guardian and The Mail on Sunday. In 2000, Ian was named business editor at The Sun and went on to twice win Business Journalist of the Year before leaving to become business and city editor at The Times. Moving into television and now at Sky, Ian is building a reputation for an uncompromising interview style. Ian, thank you for joining me.
Hello.
So, Ian, I've been watching your 6:30 p.m. show since you've done it, basically. I consider it essential viewing, so I am a fan here. I have to declare that in advance. This will be a soft focus interview. But do you find the global financial volatility at the moment actually makes the programme much more hard-hitting and much more interesting for you as a journalist?
Well, funnily enough, I mean, there hasn't actually been much volatility in markets over the last year or so, which I think has been slightly problematic. Although, obviously, the economic backdrop is pretty uncertain right now, particularly here in the UK. I mean, the big story for me of last year was the way that you had coordinated growth right across the world's major economies. You had the US growing at nearly 3%, China obviously growing at 6.75%. Even in the Eurozone, for the first time since the sovereign debt crisis, you had growth coming through there. So for me, that was the big story of last year. But yeah, the news agenda is always pretty busy. There's always loads going on. And I think that probably helps us. I think what also helps me particularly is the fact that Sky News has such global reach. We're on in more than 100 countries. And I get a sense of that from the correspondence I get from viewers right across the world. We're very big in Africa. We're very big in the Middle East. I get correspondence from Australia. So, and the other parts of the Far East as well. So, I mean, we do try and be a global business news channel. So there's always something to talk about.
What was the move into television like?
Well, I've done a bit of broadcasting. I mean, I've done a fair bit of radio in the past. The TV that I'd done was, I used to appear as a presenter's friend for Jeff Randall when Jeff presented this show.
I mean, initially, remember Jeff?
Well, Jeff did it. I mean, the genesis of this show really is Jeff Randall Live. Jeff joined Sky News, I think, in 07. Initially, it was one day a week. And then when the financial crisis came, I think Sky News themselves realised that there was potential for a nightly business show. I mean, initially, when it was weekly, I used to appear alongside Jeff every week. And then, obviously, that wasn't possible when it went nightly. So I'd kind of had some experience of it, but it's a completely different ballgame being a presenter's friend to actually presenting it.
But your working day must be completely different, because before you were building up your contacts and then writing stuff, whereas now you've got to presumably write differently for the screen. It's more, your recognisability must have gone up as well.
Well, I don't just write all of the scripts. I mean, I have colleagues that work on those as well. So it's a team effort. I guess one of the bigger differences is you can't go out and socialise as much during the middle of the day, because I mean, quite often I do a lot of live hits for, you know, if stories are breaking. So, for example, yesterday we had a profits warning from Debenhams. So I did about 7 live hits during the course of the day on Debenhams. And that's a bit different from newspapers, where you're trying to go out in the middle of the day and sort of talk to people, and where you're conscious of the fact that you have a deadline coming up, but you have a bit more flexibility in terms of movement, really, than quite often. And, you know, I'm busy all day long preparing, you know, occasionally preparing packages, going out and pre-recording interviews on location from time to time as well. So, you know, the sort of rhythm of the working day is different, but in terms of the hours, they're broadly similar to what I was doing at the Times.
Do you enjoy this lifestyle more now than you did the previous lifestyle?
It's different. It's good fun. It's good fun. I mean, the best thing about being a journalist, wherever you are, is that you're meeting different people, different walks of life, and that's really what is very interesting and enjoyable. And I mean, I've always been a business journalist. That's what my interest is specifically. So, you know, I'm always interested in learning what makes businesses tick, and making economies tick as well, for that matter. So it's good fun. I mean, I think the biggest difference was that at the Times I was running a team of reporters, and, you know, it's quite the Times business and city pages are a big train set, with which to play. Whereas TV is slightly different, you know, the business presenter isn't in charge of editorial content necessarily. You know, there's a producer that who ultimately calls the shots on that, and whilst I have input into that, it's not my decision, and that took a bit of getting used to.
Well, in fact, it's an odd thing, isn't it? Because when you'd write an article before as a journalist, there would be your byline there, whereas now, as you've rightly pointed out, it's a huge team effort.
Yeah, although it's my name over the door, ultimately.
Yes.
So, which means that, I mean, as I say, that's taken quite a bit of getting used to. I mean, I understand in America the culture is very different, where you have the sort of presenter-editor kind of setup, which just doesn't exist in the UK, and probably quite rightly. I mean, I think that when I first came over to TV, that was apart from obviously, you know, mastering all the sort of skills, which some people will probably say that I haven't mastered any, in any case. But that was getting used to. That was things like, hang on, why are we doing this story when I don't necessarily think it's all that worthwhile? And, you know, you have to sort of swallow that and think, oh, hang on, well, you know, the program producer or, you know, the output editors think it's of worth and value to the channel. So there's still a robust debate going on, whereas at the times I was running the section, so it was, you know, right, this is what we lead with, we'll put this story there and this story there, and we'll lead that page with this story and all the rest of it. So it's a bit of getting used to. The epiphany for me was actually, I saw Jeremy Paxman interviewed on stage, and someone asked him about, you know, whether he had issues with running orders on programmes, and he said, yeah, frequently. You know, he was asked, you know, he sort of came in one day and he said, well, why in the hell am I being asked to interview Russell Brand? You know, what's that got to do with anything?
It was great telly, actually, as I remember.
And he thought, well, you know, ultimately, you know, it's the editor's decision and I have to go along with it. So, and I thought, well, blimey, if Jeremy Paxman can suck it up, then I certainly should be able to.
Does telly change the way that you would report a story? So, for example, a year or two ago, we had Jeremy Vine on the podcast, and he was saying that he used to present the Today programme many, many moons ago and then moved to Newsnight. When, in fact, before then, he became the BBC's Africa correspondent. And he was saying that it really did reframe the way that he would even approach a story, to the point where sometimes, if they couldn't get pictures, even though it might have been an interesting newspaper story or even something good for radio, they just wouldn't run it on Newsnight because there was no image. Just to show.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I find that quite disappointing at times. I mean, that was, again, that was another thing I had to get used to when I came over. And the first producer of Ian King Live, a guy called Peter Hoskins, who is now at Bloomberg Television, great, great guy, great colleague. And I'd sort of regularly come in and say, well, hang on, have you seen this and all the rest of it? And quite often it was an Arcane story, but I get quite excited about Arcane stories from time to time, and I'd say, well, Hosko, look, this is really good, why don't we do this? And he'd say, yeah, great story, mate, what do we point the camera at? And yeah, that is a real issue. So by definition, telly is quite tabloidy. When I worked on The Sun, for example, you know, the thing I would always say to people, you know, particularly PRs when they were pitching stories, is think pictures. You know, The Sun is a very, very visual format. The words are very important, but think pictures, always think how we're going to illustrate the story. And that's true 10 times over in TV.
Did you always want to be a journalist? And did you always want to be a business journalist? How did you end up doing business journalism?
It was quite a long story. I mean, I was always, yeah, I always wanted to be a journalist. I mean, I remember at the age of 8 at primary school when we were doing a sort of school assembly one time. And I can't remember quite what the sort of subject matter was, but we decided to dress up the particular topic as a sort of TV show. My dad went into the garage and got an iron bar and attached a bit of flex to the bottom of it, and he said, well, there you go, this looks like a sort of interviewer's thing. And I played the part of the interviewer. So it was, you know, it was something I'd always wanted to do. I mean, from an early age, I was reading, you know, from the age of about sort of 5 or 6, I was reading newspapers, always wanted to do it. This is a very long story, actually, Paul. Have you had the time?
Yeah, we've got the time, please.
Well, I mean, I wanted to be a journalist right from the get go. At university, I edited the student union newspaper, which was an elected role, and that was at Manchester, which is the biggest union newspaper in the country.
So, could we dig up a manifesto for when you stood for newspaper editor?
It would be quite bland. It wouldn't give much away, I assure you. But as part of that, there was a time towards the end of that time. So we're talking about late 1980s here. And the Telegraph were at that point desperately scrabbling around to try and get younger people in their newspapers, a perennial problem for all newspapers, really. And they sent a couple of fellas up from the features desk. They were producing a big student special, and they said, well, can we meet you and meet some of the people that put the newspaper out? And I said, yeah, of course. So we had a nice chit-chat and a couple of pints afterwards, and they said, so is this what you want to do when you graduate? And I said, yeah, definitely. And they said, well, you'll have no problem getting a job in newspapers with this on your CV. And of course, when push come to shove, that turned out not to be the case. And I was, I guess, a sort of young guy in a hurry and probably a bit arrogant and thought, well, I don't really fancy schlepping around on regional newspapers for years, which was, looking back on it, as I say, it's quite an arrogant approach. And I thought, well, the best way to get onto Fleet Street is probably to do a post-grad course, you know, like the ones at Cardiff and at City University. But I'm not going to have the budget for that. I'm not going to get a grant. So what can I do in the meantime to sort of put some money in my pocket? So I joined the Midland Bank Group Training Scheme and ended up working most of that time in the City of London, which was great fun. But did that for about 3.5 years. But I always had a journalistic hankering. And
so at that point, did you see yourself as a temporary thing and then you would go into journalism, or had you already decided?
Yeah, I mean, it was always a means to an end, to be honest.
Well, what a great way to learn about business, though, to be in business.
Yeah, that's right. And it was an interesting job, and I met and worked with some really interesting people. I mean, I was on the main sort of foreign exchange dealing room floor of Midland Montague the day that Mrs. Thatcher resigned, which was quite a dramatic moment. And of course, this is pre-internet, you know, 24-hour news. Sky News had only just got going there. So we were probably one of the first few people in the country to when the head chief economist got on the squawk box and said the prime minister's just resigned. It was quite a gripping moment. I remember turning around to colleagues at the time and saying, you know, this is our JFK moment, because for people of my age group, you know, Mrs. Thatcher was the sort of defining figure of our times.
I'd never known any other prime minister when she resigned.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit older than that, but again, I mean, it's the old journalistic itch. I remember sort of coming back from, I'd gone home for lunch at school one day, and I came back, and on the radio, Mr. Wilson had resigned in 1976. I sort of came in bursting to tell the teacher the prime minister's resigned. So that was quite an exciting moment. Yeah, so I was about 8, I think, at the time. At the bank, yeah, it was good fun, but I always wanted to do it. So eventually I saved up my money, went to City University, and they gave me a place on the course, which was great. And you do placements during that time in a regional newspaper at Christmas and a national newspaper at Easter if you can. And Linda Christmas, who ran the course. Everyone in journalism, well, I think everyone anywhere, well, there'll be someone out there that's given them some great advice somewhere. And for me, it was Linda Christmas. And she said to me, well, what do you want to do when you finish this course? What sort of areas of journalism are you interested in?
I can't let you go on without saying Linda's got an absolutely fantastic name, by the way.
Oh, she's absolute doyen, you know. Great lady. And she said, well, what are you thinking? I said, well, probably politics, maybe sport. And she said, if you want my advice, you'll look at nothing but business. She said, you've worked in the city, you're obviously good with numbers, which is something a lot of journalists aren't, although interestingly I think they're getting better, you know, with this sort of data journalism that's sort of taking off now, but that wasn't the case sort of 25 years ago. And she said, look, business journalism is going to be the boom area over the next couple of decades. I recommend you look at nothing else. So I did my Easter placement at the Telegraph City office, working for the redoubtable Neil Collins, a sort of legend of business journalism, and called me in and said, well, when you've done your course, come back and work for us. And that was that.
So that's when you set sail on the course of I'm now a business or an aspiring business journalist.
Yeah, and I've never done anything else. I mean, a lot of people, it irritates me, actually. A lot of people sort of see business journalism as a stepping stone to other things, you know, and it's seen as a bit of a ghetto in some quarters. And that really angers me, you know, because business journalism is...
It's journalism.
It's journalism.
It's
yeah.
people. It's stories.
Exactly.
It's tension.
All
it's
all journalism is about people, you know, and in our neck of the woods, you know, those people are organised into things called businesses, or bigger ones called economies, or smaller ones called partnerships. But business is all about people. same as every other walk of life with journalism. So I think people just look at it and think, oh, it's a bit jargony, it's a bit mathsy, you know, steer clear of it. But it's not true.
Is it a challenge, though, that you have to explain it as you're saying it? So, for example, you know, if I was a local newspaper journalist and some bloke's abducted a young kid, it's a straight story. You can tell it. Whereas, you know, if someone's been involved in a conspiracy to rig LIBOR, my first question as a viewer or as a listener is, what the hell's LIBOR and who's the bad guy here and what have they done?
Well, I think that's a bit of a misconception. I mean, I always used to say when I worked on The Sun, and it was one thing that I learned from The Sun, is that there isn't a story that can't be distilled into three or four paragraphs. You know, tabloid journalism, it's like a bus stop conversation. So it's, you see these guys have been sent to prison. Yeah, what have they done? Well, they rigged LIBOR. What's that? Oh, that's the rate that one bank lends to another bank at. Oh, here's the bus. There are most, even with complex business stories, I would say most of it can be distilled down fairly easily. You just have to think about how you would. I mean, funnily enough, I said it to a guest yesterday, and we were talking about MiFID, which is the new markets in financial instruments directive, the second iteration under the European Commission. You know, it's cost something like 2.7 billion euros for the city to prepare for. It's a massive, massive piece of legislation. Literally thousands of people in the markets have been preparing for this for years. It's quite a chewy topic, and we had a guest on who was talking about it, and she said, "Well, how detailed do you want me to be on this?" And I said, "Look, ideally, tell it how you explain it to your mum."
Yes,
I mean, we have quite an interest. We have quite a Catholic audience, I think, in terms of our show on Sky News. You know, there'll be a lot of people in the city watching it, people with financial expertise. But there will also be people like your mum watching it as well, who may not necessarily be. So we do have to try and strip away the jargon from time to time. Now, I mean, that's one thing I'm always quite careful to do when a guest comes on. If they lapse into jargon, you've got to pull them up on it and say, right, well, that means this, yeah.
You've got to keep it accessible. Do you ever get the pressure from the other side, though, from the more business and economically literate audience, those people that are in the city that do want you to go a little bit more niche and more use more jargon, more sector-specific?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I do get quite a lot of feedback on that basis saying, well, why didn't you go into this more? And, you know, the answer is, well, partly because we are trying to be all things to all people, all viewers, but also, you know, the average duration of an interview on the show is only around sort of 3.5, 4 minutes, 5 if you're really, really lucky. And there are only so many questions that you can ask in an interview of that length.
You must have an incredible breadth of business knowledge, though, because as you mentioned earlier, a story could break tomorrow where you might have to do 7 or 8 very quick live pieces hours in advance of the package that you might ultimately do, where you have to kind of talk around a topic. I mean, is that an exhilarating problem to have, or is it always, oh, shoot, you know, I've got to go live in 4 minutes to talk for 3 minutes on something and I don't actually quite know what I'm going to say? Or is that the thrill of it?
That's quite good. No, I quite enjoy that when that happens, actually. It's quite good fun. You know, we ought to be good. Blimey, I've been doing this for 25 years now. You know, I ought to know my way around. You know, I mean, the thing that people say about journalists is that, you know a little about a lot, and I probably do fall into that category, I guess.
So instead of just a minute, you can actually do sort of... Does the director say to you or the producer, right, I need you for 5 minutes to talk about this new thing that's happened? Do you have a moment where you have to familiarise yourself to what's happening already?
Yeah. I mean, you're normally scrambling around, sort of, right, print off the statement. You know, that's a big... Getting the printer office printer to work, and if you're going to have to try and read from a statement, that's the hardest part normally, or getting the laptop to work.
This might be an odd question, a very vague question to ask, but how has business journalism changed over the years? You know, given the internet, that a lot of the breaking news is done via social media now, is it more television-led? Are you doing more analysis? Is there a kind of overall narrative to with the way that business journalism is going, rather than how it might have been, say, 10 or even 20 years ago? Have you seen a change?
Yeah, it's undoubtedly been a change. I mean, we're quite fortunate on 24-hour news in that we have the first sort of bite of a breaking news story. Probably the greater pressure on that basis is for the newspapers, because they're the guys that have to, you know, add value to a story when it may be 12, 16, 18, even 24 hours old in some cases. So,
because they don't have the luxury of saying, hey, this thing's just happened.
Yeah, so by definition, they're going to be more analytical quite a lot of the time. Although, obviously, they all have websites and they're putting up stuff on the websites. I mean, there is a definite convergence right across the media, which is quite interesting, really. I mean, that was something with which we were grappling in newspapers for years, you know, and I would get reporters that said, well, I don't want to write for the website. You know, if I wanted to be a Wire reporter, I'd have gone and joined Reuters. And you say, well, hang on, you have to be able to write for the website now. You know, occasionally you might have to do a piece to camera if there's a visual, if there's going to be a visual element in what we put up online as well. And you're now seeing that in TV, and we've been having all those conversations in Sky News. And again, that's, I think, for some people that, you know, they didn't necessarily want to be a writer, you know, they were a broadcaster. So that's where the convergence has come in. We are getting sort of closer in terms of what we're offering at times.
But your background in written journalism surely must better equip you to do this job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I write more for our website than any other presenter on Sky News. I'm pretty sure of that. I mean, I write at least 750 words a day most days.
And you still enjoy that?
Yeah, I do, yes. And it's actually very helpful, particularly when we've got a story that we're covering on the show. It helps get my brain in gear to sort of start thinking about it, because I'm reading up on it thoroughly and then writing a piece on it. But I mean, the other big difference to which you alluded is it's the fact that 20, 25 years ago, if you had a story, if you had an exclusive, it was yours. And it had a shelf life. The shelf life of an exclusive now is 30 seconds. You know,
if that.
It's perishable. I think actually, I mean, probably you're seeing that in investigative journalism especially, you know, where the value of an exclusive is retained there by having a good day two that you know that no one else will have. So, you know, if you've got a cache of leaked documents or whatever, then you can. I mean, the classic of the genre, I guess, is the MP's expenses.
And the Panama Papers, like you said. I mean,
yeah.
They're the gift that keeps on giving, because you can't do the whole lot on day one, and therefore, inevitably, you're going to have to spread it over 10 amazing days where you can break news every day.
Well, it's quite funny that. I mean, I do remember when the MP's expenses thing broke, and obviously I was on The Times, and it was a Telegraph story.
They bought the CDs, didn't they?
They did. And and of course, the Telegraph very savvily were sort of giving Sky News a hint every evening of what was coming up in that day's paper. So day one, they hit the Labour Party because they were in power at the time. Day two, it was the Tories who were the main opposition. Then on day three, the Wednesday, I think, I saw James Harding, who was then the editor, walking out of the building. We're walking out of the building at roughly the same time. And I said, nah, it can't be much longer, James. You know, they're on to the Lib Dems tomorrow, all over by the end of the week, won't it? Yeah. And blimey, they kept it going for another 4 or 5 weeks. Incredible stuff.
It was incredible, because it was the first time for me where I saw journalists kind of almost stage managing the PR of the story's impact themselves. Because
yeah.
In the old days, they'd have probably just broken the whole lot in one go. Yeah. And just there might have been, you know, some appendix at the back or a special supplement yeah. that says, here's all there was a deliberate way there to actually space the story out and group the stories, segment them by, as you said, political party and everything, and they kept it going.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, papers like The Sun and The Mail and The Mirror have always been very good at that. Because particularly on a buy-up, you know, you always want to keep, you know, you don't shoot all your best stuff in one go. You keep it back and drip it out day after day after day. And, the Telegraph were really, really savvy on that. So I think the rise of the internet and the need to sort of have exclusives and preserve the value of an exclusive has definitely become more of a challenge for, particularly for newspapers, but also for TV as well. You know, you have to have a good day two story in the jargon.
How do you find chief executives these days? Are they more willing to appear on the show? I mean, because we work for chief executives, that's what we do. And some of them, you know, would come on your show even if you were going to have a go at them. They would love the spotlight. Others...
You must give me their names yeah, and addresses.
Yeah. Well, others would love to come on, but their corporate comms team, who are traditionally risk-averse, would say, oh, we don't want the CEO on, he might say something. Well, yeah, obviously. And then there are others that just... It's just in their nature that they wouldn't even dream of coming on a show like this.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes have to kind of prize the CEO out of a company to get them on?
Yeah, you do. And that definitely impacts sometimes the tone. I mean, you know, business people don't have to do TV. It's not like a politician where, you know, you can come on and, you know, be as rude as you like to them, and same time next week then, John, you know, and back they come. Business people don't have to do telly. So that is the challenge.
There's always a tension, isn't there? Because I remember reading a political memoir a few years ago. I forgot which one it was, but they were saying that the problem with 10 Downing Street is if you went too hard on them, that you just wouldn't get the info anymore. And there was always a tension with the journalists, which is you need them to have the story, and yet you also have to hold them to account, but you need their cooperation to do that. Yeah. Is there how do you manage that? Because to me, how do you square that circle?
Well, I mean, basically, you start from the point, if someone's actually agreed to come on, then you do have a certain license to sort of ask whatever you want, and I think that's more or less acknowledged when someone agrees to be, when a CEO agrees to be interviewed, you know that they're basically giving you carte blanche to ask what you want. But if it's a horrendous experience, they'll never come back again.
Yeah,
and so you do have to sort of weigh that and be thoughtful to. I always remember when I mean, I learned an awful lot from Jeff when he was doing, we used to do Five Live Weekend Business. I mean, that was the sort of predecessor of this show on Sky News, essentially. And I always saw the way that Jeff put CEOs at their ease. And he'd always sort of say to them, he said, I'm going to just give you a friendly full toss that you can smash to the boundary for four, just to put them at their ease. And I always thought that was a very good interviewing technique. That was quite a, you can ask the tough stuff later. But if you come in straight away and just sort of, I put it to you, you know, you're beating your wife up.
Yeah.
You know, you're not really going to get very far. But there are, as you say, some people who will never, ever do TV at all. I mean, the classic one was, I mean, God bless him, he's just died, Richard Cousins of Compass Group, who I'd known for quite a long time when it was announced I was leaving the Times to join Sky News. He was one of the first people to drop me an email and say congratulations. And I said, well, Richard, you know, when can we look forward to you coming on? He said, you'll never get me on. And he was as good as his word. I mean, he hated doing, I think he only did about three or four interviews ever, just sort of profile type pieces. He absolutely hated doing them. For him, it was, right, it's all about the business, it's not about me. So he was one person that I've never been able to get on. That was quite frustrating, actually, because he was very entertaining company, and he always had interesting things to say.
Do you think he was just personally uncomfortable then with being on camera?
Some people are. I mean, another good example was Stuart Gulliver, who's just stepped down as CEO of HSBC, and just refused point blank to do telly. I think he'd done some initially, and then obviously the crisis hit, and in the sort of subsequent backlash against the bankers, I think he just sort of sat there and took a very hard-nosed decision and thought, right, well, there is no upside for me in doing interviews on TV anymore, so I'm not going to do them. And he'd quite happily talk to newspapers, he'd quite happily talk to TV reporters on a background basis, but get him in front of a camera, no chance. And again, that was a really frustrating one, because he was he's a very learned guy. HSBC is a fascinating organisation with offices all over the world. He's got insights into all kinds of economies around the world, and he's a very entertaining guy with a sort of a dry sense of humour. He'd make a great TV interviewee, but as I say, he saw no upside in it. So it is getting people on is sometimes a challenge. It's an easier sell with some of the consumer facing businesses. I mean, if you take someone like Dave Lewis at Tesco, or Mike Coop at Sainsbury's, or Dave Potts at Morrison's, you know, they realise, you know, they're not only do they employ hundreds of thousands of people in their organisations, so there's a ready-made audience who are going to be gagging to hear what they have to say, but also, you know, they have millions and millions of customers coming through their doors every week. They have lots of stakeholders, so it's just common sense for organisations like that to appear on TV.
It is an opportunity, like you say, because everyone is going to be watching your show. Their own shareholders, stakeholders, employees, you know, all of those customers, as you've just said. It's a great opportunity to actually lead from the front. I remember when that poor young woman lost her legs on the Alton Towers ride, and the CEO went on Kay Burley's show that night.
Yeah.
And she rightly laid into him. And I respect her for doing that, because there would have been a terrible accident. It could have been a lot worse, and was terrible. But I also thought he came across well, because
Merlin, yeah.
Because he actually, you could tell he genuinely was upset, and he was going to get to the bottom of it, and he was going to sort it out. And ultimately, that is what you want to walk away from a selfish point of view, to show people that you are serious about making sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and funnily enough, I think that's that imperative has grown over recent years, and I think partly down to social media, possibly. I mean, if you take another tragedy, the kids who died on the Thomas Cook holiday in Crete, Thomas Cook had gone through several CEOs before Peter Fankhauser, who's now the current CEO, actually said, we've got to talk about this. And because previously, I mean, you mentioned that comms chiefs are very risk averse. I mean, in this particular instance, you also have in-house lawyers who are incredibly risk averse and say, well, no, you can't do that.
You can't say sorry because that could be an admission of liability. Although the law's changed on that now, of course.
Exactly, yeah. But Peter Fankhauser, to give him immense credit, was a very, very honourable thing to do. And he just sort of said, I'm sorry, not only am I going to meet the parents, which neither of his two predecessors had done. And he said, we're going to meet them, we're going to say sorry, and I'm going to go on the TV and explain what we've done. You know, immensely brave and honourable thing for him to do.
Does it work where you have to force yourself to go in a little bit harder with an interviewee if you happen to have known them for many years and you might know a little bit of the background, but of course you have to do your job as a journalist where you have to give them maybe a rougher time than on air than you would, say, do in the pub?
Yeah, occasionally.
How does that work after the interview then? I always remember when Jeremy Paxman famously interviewed Michael Howard and asked him that question, you know, whether he'd threatened to overrule Derek Luce all those times. And at the end, when the credits had rolled, kind of Michael Howard threw his microphone on the desk and Jeremy said, oh, did that go well? And he went, well, how do you think it went? Do you know what I mean? It was a bit personal. Because, yeah. I mean, you are doing a job. You've got a job to do. Surely your interviewees would respect that.
Most of them do. I mean, a good example was where we had Sir Jerry Grimstone on, the chairman of Standard Life, and that was on the night that they'd announced a merger with Aberdeen Asset Management. And Martin Gilbert, the CEO of Aberdeen, is someone that we've had on quite a few times in the past. And Martin, I think, was up in Scotland addressing the troops. And Standard Life said, well, Jerry will come on, and he'll quite happily chat about it. And I sort of said to him during the interview, I said, look, you've obviously got a situation with co-chief executives, you know, which is never a recipe for a harmonious boardroom. And I said, look, Jerry, the chit-chat around the city is that in a year from now, you're going to move on and become the Barclays chairman. Martin's going to become chairman, and Keith Skeoch will remain CEO of this merged business. And he sort of, you know, that was a really difficult question for him to answer. And he just sort of said, well, I can't comment on speculation. And he got out of it very,
the
very...
The minister's response.
Elegant. Yeah, he did it very, very elegantly. But, I mean, that was a horrifically difficult question for him to answer. And he got out of it very well. And afterwards, he was very decent about it. And I said, look, sorry, that was an awkward question for you. And he said, you've got to ask it, you know. And his PR advisor said, well, and you'll notice how well he got round it as well. So he'd obviously briefed him to, here's a potential bear trap that you might fall into.
Is it more challenging as a business journalist, given the nature of the organisations that you're reporting on, if you, for example, you get it wrong, even honestly? So, for example, if you're a political reporter and you say something wrong about an MP, it'll be corrected, but they're not going to sue. Whereas you're actually reporting on organisations that potentially have very deep pockets. And yep. Also, if you get a factual thing wrong, even yep. in good faith, it could materially affect their share price. I see business journalists as actually more vulnerable as a journalist than say, in other sectors.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, that's absolutely true. We have to be, the people we write about will sue you if you get it wrong.
And presumably that's front of mind with every hit of the keyboard that you do.
You have to, it's always there. It's always there. It's really changed with the advent of the internet. You know, the sort of cycle in which complaints would emerge. I mean, and every journalist will tell you, I mean, dealing with corrections and requests for... corrections and complaints it's an absolute pain in the backside because it's all rear view mirror stuff. As a journalist, you're always looking for the next thing that's going to happen, the next story, the next development. The last thing you want to be doing is, oh, blimey, we cocked that up, you know, and now I'm going to have to sit and haggle with a lawyer for hours on end. It's tedious and time consuming. But the cycle has changed, and PRs are very, very rapid now to sort of jump. If you've written something online, they'll just jump on you and just sort of say, well, that's not right. Can you correct it?
But even then, as a journalist, you have to double check and think, well, actually, I think it is right.
You do.
You don't have to just do what they say.
You do. But the advance, you know, the the advance of online copy and online editions means that you're under greater pressure than ever before to get stuff out in a very timely manner. And I think it's imperative on companies to make sure people have got all the details that they want. I mean, quite often it's a useful way of sort of flushing out everything you need to from a company. But equally, the cycle in which corrections are demanded and changes requested
is tightened.
Yeah. I mean, it's down to hours now, whereas previously it would be days, weeks, or months, or even years.
What's a typical day like for you then? How do you put the show together? What time do you get up? Because, I mean, you're on air in the evening. Presumably you've then got to get home and, it's quite late nights.
A typical day is, I'm up. It probably starts the night before. I mean, the last thing I do before turning in is look at some of the newspaper websites before turning in. Typically the FT or the Wall Street Journal, see what they've got coming up for the next day. By around 11:30 midnight, most of them will have that day's the next day splash up. So you'll be looking at that and seeing what they've got. Then obviously, there are certain landmark, the Today programme business strands are very important.
I've listened to Wake Up to Money for about 20 years. Mickey Clark's still on that show as well.
I know. I used to stand in for Mickey in the old days.
What a legend.
Yeah, crikey. I did that for 3 weeks. There was one period of doing that and then a full day at the newspaper afterwards was killing.
They've stopped hiding that he's not in Salford now, which is good. I think they've acknowledged it on air.
Yeah. I did it for 3 weeks one time, standing in for Mickey, and then doing the day job afterwards. And by the end of it, I was practically hallucinating through lack of sleep.
Imagine. What time did it start then? Because it's at 5:15 now.
Yeah, it was 5:30 in those days. So you had to be in the studio for about 10 to 5. And then, so that involved kind of getting up at that 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous hour, an ungodly hour.
Yes, I shouldn't admit it. There was one particular occasion where I think I came straight from the pub to the studio. It'd been a late night the night before. I think that was on a bank holiday, though, so I had a certain amount of flexibility there. I'll be doing all that. I'm constantly, you're constantly checking emails. And I mean, it's not unusual to be contacted fairly early doors. I mean, Mark Kleiman, my colleague, he tends to do the sort of very early stuff. I mean, Mark's usually in by about 6 in the morning. So if there's any sort of stuff that hits the stock exchange screens first thing at 7 a.m., Mark's usually the one that tends to do that. But, I mean, he works incredibly hard, incredibly long hours. Absolute Stakhanovite work ethic. And then quite often I'll do a breakfast meeting with someone. Quite like to do that first thing in the morning. Then straight into the office, chat with the producers. I mean, there'll be times where we've set up an interview in advance and we'll know what's coming up. That will be the sort of landmark on the day. Or when you know that there's a big event coming on during the course of the day, like a Bank of England rates decision, and
pieces that you're going to be able to.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be many stories coming out of the Monetary Policy Committee over the last 10 years until recently. There'll be certain points in the landscape that you're going to be working around, and then the running order will take shape during the day. If there's big breaking news, I'll be on the channel talking about that from the day. I'll try and write something, as I say, for the website most days, and slipping out and meeting people. But then by about sort of 3-4:30, all you're doing really seriously thinking about is that night show, and going through the script, going through the running order, thinking about the kind of guests that you want to have on. Well, I mean, that would have been done earlier. The guest getting would have been done earlier in the day once you've decided that these are the particular stories that you want to hit. And then quite often, you might have a guest drop out on you at short notice, which is not unheard of. And, that involves some serious phone bashing when that happens.
How do you kind of live your journalistic life in terms of cycles? Is it day to day? The show goes out 4 nights a week. And then are you teeing up stories that you might run, say, next month or next quarter? How does it work in terms of your planning?
Well, to be honest, Andrew and Scott, who produce the show, do an awful lot of that. But I mean, I'm involved in that as well, and going out and meeting people. The question at the end of every meeting with a CEO or chairman is, when are you going to come on the telly then and talk about it?
Covering all of the highs and lows of business per se, you must have learnt quite a lot about business from just watching it happen. Is there anything that's that springs to mind about, would you be a better entrepreneur if you decided to start a business? Was what you've learnt, would that make you, is it something innate? Is it, have you looked at a business and you think, well, that'll be bankrupt within 3 years, and then it either has or hasn't? I remember the Sunday Times many years ago did a story about how Tesco's had launched their online ordering, and they were sneering at the fact that these people were going round with trolleys saying, well, this is ridiculous.
Dog
and,
stores,
and actually, that's turned out to be the best way to do it. And do you ever get it right? Do you get it wrong? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, I've done, yeah, I mean, there have been loads of cases where I thought, well, this company doesn't look long for this world. Yeah, and quite often that's proved to be the case.
And the opposite, of course. That, you know, long-standing institutions that no one would ever question seem to, like Lehman's, for example, can go bankrupt at the stroke of a pen.
Yeah, absolutely. But your initial question was, would I make a good entrepreneur? And I don't think I would, to be honest. I mean, I've the utmost respect for entrepreneurs, because I think they're, you know, they're very brave people. You know, you've got to back yourself wholeheartedly. You put everything on the line in a lot of cases. You know, I mean, those were the stories when I was on The Sun. I used to love those sort of stories the most. Even if it was a small company, a little IPO, even if it's only a little 10 million pound company that or name that was never going to feature in the Times or the Telegraph or the FT, I used to love those stories, because you could just turn around to the readers and say, look, here's this guy, you know, he had a great idea a few years ago, he remortgaged his home, and now he's coining it and he's a multi-millionaire. I mean, you could say, I mean, I backed myself when I left the bank and, you know, went for a year without any income and sort of ran down my savings when I went back to college and went to City University. I
mean, you were certainly enterprising about your career.
Yeah,
entrepreneurial.
I suppose it is. But I mean, I think the other big thing is you've got to have a great idea as an entrepreneur. You've got to spot a gap in the market. You know, if you look at all the great entrepreneurs, they've spotted something that no one else is doing, or they spotted something that they think they can do better than the existing competition. And I just haven't had an idea, to be honest. That's the problem.
Still time yet. Does it annoy you, though, that as a journalist, that there doesn't seem to be a lot of money in journalism these days because of the advent of digital? You know, when Jeremy Vine came on the podcast, he said, when I was at the Coventry Telegraph, you know, there'd be 30 journalists in the newsroom. Now there's three. It does seem to me that there's fewer journalism jobs than ever. And, you know, I make an apology for that, because the money seems to have gone into people like me, PR people.
It's really sad. It's desperate, and although, you know, I think it just means you have to be more thoughtful about how you approach it. I mean, if you take the Times, for example, you know, the Times is now making money for the first time in 30 years. It's a profitable newspaper, and it's done that by, first of all, making the conscious decision that it wasn't going to give away all its content for free on the internet. And so by building a subscriber base, repeat purchases, you know, that's actually, for newspapers, a real opportunity if they get it right. Selling internet subscriptions means you're selling your newspaper, you're delivering your newspaper to the same customer day after day after day, whereas quite often, you know, a newspaper purchase might be only once or twice a week. It's just, you know, passing trade. A lot of working practices have had a lot to do with that as well, by the way. I mean, one of the big challenges for a paper like The Sun that they had to think about was, most people would buy it on the way to work, on the way to the office or the factory. The decline in smoking. I actually went on, when I worked at The Sun, I was constantly nagging colleagues about this when the smoking ban came in. And I actually said, this is going to be really serious for us. And everyone said, what are you talking about? And I said, where do most people buy their cigarettes? The corner shop, the news agents. Right. So if they're not coming in for their cigarettes, then, that's a fewer opportunity for them to come in and buy a newspaper every day. Oh, yeah, you've probably got a point there. I mean, The Sun thought quite creatively about sort of how they distributed the paper. But ultimately, I mean, for the Times, if you can get people buying it every day via an online subscription, then you've got a regular customer. And that's actually proved to be quite a sustainable business model. So as I say, it's fantastic. I mean, I've been so proud to have seen the Times become a profitable
newspaper.
It's a fantastic newspaper, and
I read it every day.
And it's only £1.70. I mean, what are you going to get for that?
And we're back to actually that entrepreneurial risk taking again, because at the time when it went behind a paywall, I was one of the naysayers that said, "Well, that's ridiculous. I used to read the Times twice a week, but now I would never read it now that it had to be paid for." And of course, after a month or two, I then got a trial subscription, and because I was paying for it, rather than reading it just twice a week, I read it every day because I wanted my money's worth.
Yeah.
And now I read it every day and have done for years. I wouldn't even think of cancelling my subscription. So all the received wisdom at the time can sometimes be wrong. The other thing I like about the Times, with it being behind a paywall, is the comments, because I would never read the comments on, say, The Guardian or an open newspaper where there's all these numpties that are just spouting hate. Every single comment on the Times newspaper is paying 20 quid a month and they know their real name. So you actually get... It's sometimes a bit churlish, but at least it's constructive and interesting. But it's not one saying, "Oh, send them back" or whatever. Yeah. Horrible, hate-filled comments.
Yeah.
Semi-constructive, I would say.
Yeah, although to those other newspapers you mentioned, I think they're getting a bit better at filtering out some of the bile, which comes from left and right, let's not forget. The Times is full of engaged, it's an engaged audience. Same as CFT, or the Wall Street Journal. I mean, the readers' comments on all of those websites are endlessly interesting.
Do you read your own comments? You know, what is the interaction with your own viewers and so on?
Of course.
Do people email you that you don't know and say, "Great show, Ian"? How does that work?
If only they did. actually quite often they do. I mean, in fairness, one of the things that we do, which is very helpful, is we put up most of the interviews that we do on YouTube. We have on the Sky News YouTube channel. And that's one of the real pleasant surprises for me. I mean, we can get literally thousands of people watching some of these interviews, and that's quite interesting as well, because quite often you're taken by surprise at the things that have gone down well. That's a really useful way of engaging with the audiences as well, and seeing the sort of comments that people have underneath that. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's really valuable to get feedback and find out what people are interested in. So, I mean, it can be quite a sobering experience when you've come off air to go and have a look on Twitter and see what people are saying about it.
Because you think it either went well and you get a lot of criticism or the opposite.
It's very, very difficult to be too scientific about it at times. I mean, the same is true with the audience numbers. You get these things known as overnights. Although, you know, as you'll appreciate, TV audiences are pretty amorphous now because people are watching on catch-up. And in our case, they're watching us right around the world as well. But there's been times where I've come off air and I thought, well, that wasn't our greatest half hour. And then you see the overnights the next day and you think, crikey, you know, it was one of the most watched half hours on the channel that day. And you think, oh, okay, well, but it couldn't have been a better show. And then there's other times where I've come off air and I thought, right, we absolutely nailed it tonight. We had fantastic guests. We got good, you know, we got a good news line out of that interview. And then you'll see the overnights the next day and the numbers weren't all that great. There's no rhyme or reason to it.
It sounds like it's an emotional roller coaster then.
You have to not get too worried about it and just sort of try and do the job as best you can.
What's next for you? I mean, are you going to present this show for 40 years and then retire, or do you have an idea? And
not least because I'd be 90 if I was. I don't know. Down to the boss.
And who's the boss?
John Riley.
Oh, I was hoping he'd say something like "the viewers" or something, so I could challenge you.
The viewers, well, of course, yes, the viewers pay my wages ultimately.
We've got John coming on in a few weeks. And he's, as you know, he's a nice guy, but I actually wouldn't want to be the boss of Sky News, because it has to be quite a brutal job, really, to kind of axe things that aren't working, even if people are well-meaning. It's not, to me,
he's
not a job I want.
He's an amazing newsman. I mean, I remember when I started at Sky News, and Peter Hoskins, who was then the producer, and he said the thing you need to know about John Riley is he's an anarchist. He doesn't care who he sort of goes and shakes up and bothers. That's the way he likes it. He likes to disrupt things, and I think that's a fantastic attribute for any journalist. You know, you do want to rattle bars and rattle people's sensibilities from time to time. As we've both agreed, you know, Sky News is an amazing, fantastic news channel, and John's been in charge of it for 11 years now. I mean, that's, you know, that's more than most national newspaper editors serve. You know, it's
long time.
You get to more than 5 years as a national newspaper editor, and you're doing pretty well.
Last question then. What's been the best story that you've worked on in your career, and what's been the worst one?
Well, you mentioned earlier changes in journalism over the years. And in the old days, you'd get these sort of rolling takeover bids. You know, we used to get far more contested bids, hostile bids. And they were always great fun to do, where companies are just coming back and forth at each other and slinging mud. So, I mean, one of the favourites, I mean, it's more than 20 years ago now, but it'll always have a place in my heart because it was an exclusive that I broke, was the takeover bid by Granada for Forte in 1995. And that was just a fantastic story because it was two household names going at each other, hammer and tongs. There was mud being flung in both directions, and that was an enormously enjoyable story to work on.
And presumably your adrenaline was going throughout all of that because there was just so much happening to report on.
You feel really engaged in it. Philip Green's bid for Marks and Spencer in 2004, similarly.
I remember that.
Well, I mean, the disappointment with that one was that it didn't go on long enough, probably to the relief of both sides, but I'm sure the advisors would have liked it to have rolled on. I mean, stories like that are great fun to do.
Is the joy in the breaking of the news? We've had a few other journalists on this podcast where they say they always like to be the person that's just about to stand on the chair and tell everyone the big thing.
Yeah, of course. That's fantastic when you can do that. It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, there's no feeling quite like it in the world. And it's addictive. I mean, those are great fun stories to be doing. Whilst I've been at Sky News, I mean, I think the things that I've taken most satisfaction is when you get a big name interview, when you can persuade someone to come in front of the camera and get them to talk about something, and you know, it's the only interview that they've done that day. That's really good when you can pull that off.
It puts you on the spot though, doesn't it? Because you don't know quite necessarily you might guess what they might say, but you might not know. The old barrister's rule, isn't it, when in Crown Court, is that you would never ask a witness a question you didn't already know the answer to, because otherwise you're going to be in the shtick if you say, well, you didn't have an alibi, and then they say, well, I didn't, here's 37 witnesses. How do you stay in the moment then? Because you've got to be guided by
I quite like it when they tell me something I didn't already know, you know. I mean, if I don't know it, then the viewers certainly won't. That's quite exciting, you know. It's sort of, oh, right, okay, really, you know. And, you know, as a journalist, you want to be surprised by, you know, you hear that with John Humphreys on the Today programme quite often. He'll ask someone an answer and a question, and the way he reacts to the answer sometimes, he's clearly really, right.
I love it when John gets someone on from, like, YouTube or something that he clearly has no clue about. And I mean that benevolently to him. I wish him well. And he's been on this podcast actually, but sometimes you can tell he doesn't have a clue what he's talking. Very rarely, but it's usually about like social media or young people stuff. But
we're none of us getting any younger, are we? I mean, quite often, there are certain subjects where I know less than I do on others, and quite often I'll have done a live and I'll say to the colleagues afterwards, did that look all right? You know, you are still seeking constant assurance.
But actually, if you don't know that, frankly, that means the listener and the viewer might not know, and therefore you're entitled to start at a very basic first principles question, like, what is this about, Gov?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not a bad place to start, actually. You know, the six servants or whatever it was at Rudyard Kipling called them, who, what, when.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, that's not a bad place. You asked what was the worst story.
Yeah, that's the last question. What's the worst story?
I find regulatory stories quite chewy at times. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, in terms of business patches, there are certain sectors that a lot of business reporters will run a mile from because they report in a certain way. So in insurance companies, for example, you know, trying to read a set of accounts from an insurance company, you know, quite often you need the Rosetta Stone to translate it. You know, it's incredibly complicated. So a lot of journalists, business journalists even, will run away from insurance stories. Some people don't like writing about the oil and gas sector in particular because, again, there's a sort of unique kind of language to that. One of the things I've enjoyed doing over the years is actually getting my head around those sort of sectors, and I find them quite interesting. Commercial property is another one. A lot of people walk away from that. Again, commercial property is full of some of the most clever and brilliant people you'll find in business. So for me, those are really exciting stories. I find sort of very heavily legalistic regulatory stories a bit of a bind at times. So reporting on MiFID has been challenging, but it's important. You know, people do need to know about these sort of things. The worst stories by far are things like, you know, you mentioned earlier the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers, where a team of journalists has had access to these documents, in some cases, a year in advance. They've had a year to go through them. You're playing catch-up with them. You haven't got the source material, and yet you're on the, you know, the channel is obliged to kind of follow them up. I hate those stories.
Do you ever have to defend business itself in those kind of stories where there seems to be a narrative that, you know, every entrepreneur at that level is on the take and is trying to not pay their tax? And do you ever have to find yourself being an advocate defending business?
I think it's really unfortunate when that narrative takes hold, because it's just not true. You know, I mean, it's very boring and lazy to hear. You know, I hate it when you hear members of the public say, oh, politicians are all in it for themselves. I mean, it's absolute cobblers. They're not. I mean, yeah, a handful might be. But, and certainly the MP's.
You wouldn't go through all that agony unless you actually believed in it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and the MP's expenses affair drew out loads of really egregious examples of that. But, I mean, I know a lot of politicians, and most of them are in it for the right reasons. You know, they're quite genuine about why they're doing it. You might not agree with them necessarily, but you can't doubt their sincerity. So, I mean, that really rankles with me when people say, oh, politicians are all in it for themselves. And equally, when most people say, oh, business people, they're this, they're that. They're not. I mean, most business people are trying to do an honest day's work, like everyone is. They're just trying to do the right thing. And, you know, I'm sure there are a few egregious examples where people are trying to feather their own nests or whatever, but those people are few and far between. Most business people are trying to do the right thing. So would you necessarily say that in reporting a story like the Panama Papers? I mean, it's quite often these are not normal business people anyway. They're sort of Russian oligarchs and, you know, people who aren't normal.
Ian, that's been hugely enjoyable. Thank you ever so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.